Welcome to What Happened Next, a podcast about new-ish books. My name is Nathan Whitlock, and I'm a writer. On this podcast, I speak to other writers about what happens when their new book is no longer new, and it's time to write another one. I've already had a lot of great conversations about the weirdness and pleasure of being a writer, so please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you do enjoy these episodes, which go up every Monday morning without fail, please tell other people about them. I do this on my own, so it helps a lot. If you want to send me a suggestion for a future guest, or comment on an episode, or just find out more about what I am doing, I have books of my own, hint, hint, please go to nathanwhitlock.ca. My guest on this episode is Shema Benembarek. Shema is a journalist who has written for The Walrus, Broadview, Maisonneuve, and the Literary Review of Canada. She has worked as special reports editor at Strategy, a senior editor for Toronto Life, an events manager for The Walrus, a business development and brand communications lead at Corporate Knights, and as an associate editor at Broadview. Currently, she is a contributing writer for The Walrus. In 2020, she was chosen as one of the 5 RBC Taylor Prize Emerging Writers of the Year. Shema's first book is Halal Sex, The Intimate Lives of Muslim Women in North America, published by Viking Canada in 2023. The book was shortlisted for the QWF Concordia University First Book Prize, and journalist Robin Doolittle said about Halal Sex that it, quote, pulls vital conversations into the open. I loved every minute I spent reading this book. Shema and I talk about why she chose to include intimate details about her own life in her book, about the reactions she had been anticipating to the book, and about her new work in progress, which extends the work she did in Halal Sex. So as a journalist, you will be familiar with this idea of the power imbalance that sometimes happens when you interview somebody that you've done some research on, so you know more about them than they know about you. It feels particularly unfair right now, because I know how it went when you lost your virginity. And I know about it because you wrote about it in the book. Does that feel a little weird to have information like that out there in the world? Like just random strangers are picking up your book and going like, oh, is that how it happened?
You know, this is the best beginning of an interview I've ever experienced.
Thank you for the blurb. Thank you for the promotional blurb.
I totally, if I was as smart as you, I would have used that if I were you too. No, it doesn't feel weird at all in the sense that like I'm 41 now and like kind of like lived a life and then realized that I'm not ashamed of anything I've done.
No, of course.
You know, like I used to be. I used to think like, oh my gosh. Or I also talk about like the abortion I had at university and stuff. And for the longest time, I thought that was supposed to be like kept a secret, that I'd be judged, etc. But I find power in kind of like sharing this stuff with people who can connect with it. And It opens up the conversation more. There's nothing shameful about like being open about sexuality or your sexual experiences. Actually, the fact that we don't do that enough is what led to like, what was it? Like, you know, 18-year-old Shema being like, oh my God, is this what it is?
I mean, that's the whole concept of the book too, is like these things specifically in the culture you're writing about, but more broadly, these things have to be out in the open. And once they're out in the open, they kind of lose their power a bit, to power to shame, power to hurt.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
It still feels odd though. And again, not on the level of like shame or you should feel bad or anything, but going through your work as a journalist, as a professional writer, you have certain themes that you return to. You write about immigration and politics, a lot of corporate strategy, but there's not a lot of like super oversharey memoir pieces in your portfolio. Did you find it you had to get yourself in a place where you were writing about yourself almost as a third person, like almost as one of your subjects, and less about like I'm revealing myself?
Yeah, I've never been interested in writing about like myself or writing memoir pieces or anything like that, aside from these little, bits that eventually I made sense to incorporate in this book,
Right.
I feel like I had a very easy, privileged life, to be honest. It's like nothing to really report there.
That's refreshing to hear from a writer. It's like, yeah, no trauma, no problems. It's been smooth sailing,
Good
actually.
parents, everything's great.
Yeah.
But then when it came to this topic, I was in an MFA program at the University of King's College when I first started working on it. I realized that in talking with my mentor, who at the time was Ayelet Sabari, fantastic writer and woman, we kind of came to the agreement that it brought something more to know that I am an insider of the community, that the reason that I'm so interested in that topic and that I actually spent all this time working on it and talking to all these people, and also the reason why they even trusted me to tell me all their stories, is that I was one of them and that I understood, the experiences that they went through. And so as a writer, I had to there was a resistance in the beginning. I was like, ah, not because I was embarrassed of it, but because for the longest time in my head, I had this like idea that like real journalists and real writers don't write about themselves.
You don't want to be your own subject. You don't want to get into the story. Yeah.
Exactly. That it's not as professional if I were to actually talk about myself versus the people that I'm reporting on. But with time, it just served as a really nice like frame to the book.
It reminds me of a story I actually share with my students, writing and publishing students at Humber, about Desmond Cole's piece for Toronto Life, the skin I'm in. I don't actually know. Were you working at Toronto Life when that was
No, not
published?
at the time,
That was
no.
slightly that was before you, I think. But I've talked to Mark Pupo, who commissioned that piece, and Emily, who worked on it. From what they told me, and I don't think it's a secret, I'm not telling tales out of school, the first version of that piece that Desmond wrote was very repertorial and third person, and their stories and data and information and statistics and facts. And they went back to him and said, I think this needs to be more personal. And I think he was a little initially reluctant for the same, probably for the same reasons of like, will that make it less journalism, less, or even was there ever a concern for you that? Because putting yourself in that story makes complete sense when you look at it that the way you were, Ayelet, were looking at it. But there's also a cultural thing of like certain people would not take it as seriously, as like, oh, you're doing that whole like my story is important because it's my story thing. It's only important because I'm part of it, and like you said, there's those people who would say, keep it all third person, right? Tell me why it's important by keeping it separate from you. Was that some of your concern too, of like you don't want people to think it was more trivial because it was personal somehow?
Exactly. And I think also I was writing at a time where there was a lot of talk in the industry about memoir writing not being real journalism or like
That's
being,
it. Yeah. That's what
you
I
know
was
what I mean?
thinking of. Yeah.
I can't remember his name at the top of my head right now, but like there was someone who wrote, I think it was a publisher who wrote about like this like little op-ed piece about how, I'm sure you remember the name, about how grants that are being given out to writers, should they all be memoir writers and memoir books and things like that? And that what's happening to like, the industry and the sector in Canada when there is no more, like fully investigative reporting pieces with just facts, and we're losing something by veering off to like the memoir. Hearing that kind of stuff, that chatter, like in the industry as well, which kind of like compounded the idea that like, oh well, if like look at what the people in the industry are saying, that this is not, it's not serious journalism, which is completely idiotic,
Yeah.
really.
I remember the piece you're talking about. I can't remember who wrote it. It sounds like possibly Jonathan Kay or Ken White or
I think
someone
Ken
in
White.
that. It may have been Ken White.
Yeah.
there's almost a odd parallel between that conversation and what you write about in the book of like, it's important that we don't reveal these embarrassing, shameful things about ourselves. And that's, your book is soaked in that of like, this has to be revealed.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And I think the entire book completely changed my perspective and the way that I approach this job of being a journalist or a writer.
Oh, how so?
There was, in the beginning, I was having such a hard time figuring out how to report on a community that is this marginalized, but also that I belong to, and torn between like allegiances. Like, am I, you know, should I be talking to them as this, like, you know, kind of like removed from the subject, kind of professional, you know, journalist who doesn't reveal anything about herself, so that, you know, and then doesn't show them their pieces at the end, and all of this stuff that I've kind of grew up understanding is what journalism is. And for many reasons that works, but also there are many reasons why that kind of like framework doesn't work. And it, and in the circumstances of this book, it didn't, because I was going into the homes of these people and spending time with them. And in the same way that, you know, you started this conversation that, you know, I knew all the stuff about them, mm-hmm. and they didn't know anything about me. And then all of a sudden, you know, 4 years into these conversations we were having online, I was showing up at their doorstep, and that completely freaked them out. Right. I didn't find any support or any guidance as to how to do that work. Like, I spoke to a bunch of my editor friends and, like, you know, people who are, that I super respect in this sector. And there wasn't that much information about how to like report on marginalized communities when you're one of them and you feel torn between your people and your job.
In the process of making it, you mentioned you were working on an MFA, and it was years. You did spend those 4 years doing all that research and interviewing these people. Did the book begin as a book, or was it going to be a magazine article? Or did you have a sense of what you wanted it to be? Was it always aiming towards being a book?
It was initially, I thought I was going to write it as a long form piece, you know, even before I started working on it as a book. So like, I don't know, a handful of years ago. And at the time I was taking this course with David Hayes about like long form magazine writing and all of that. And I told him about this, the concept, and he was just like, this is so much bigger than an article. This is so much bigger than a feature piece. He's like, it would be a great feature, but it's so much bigger than that. You should really consider a book. And I had never thought about that until, you know, he'd said it. So that's when I, you know, kind of embarked on the book train.
And did you pitch it to an editor, or did you have an agent that was brought it to an editor at Penguin Random House? Or did you kind of have multiple conversation with multiple editors?
So my experience is not the norm, which is why when like I get asked to talk to students and stuff like that, I disclaim that. Because then it sounds like, oh, you know, this, it's so easy to do this. But I think what happened to me was just like being at the right place at the right time and the right person. And all those things kind of like came together. I was chosen as one of the emerging writers for the Taylor Prize program.
Oh, right. Yes.
I was working with Robin Doolittle. She was the journalist assigned to me, and she's also lovely and fun. Mm-hmm. So as soon as my name was kind of put on that press release and that list and all of that stuff, and a blurb was shared about like the project that I'm working on and everything, I was contacted by, I'd say like 4 agents or something like that. And I think that's what they do, which is smart. You got to look at these lists,
of course,
right? And find your next clients. And that's just how it works. But I think also the topic, sex and Islam, and this like Arab journalist and all of these things are just like really exciting. But I ended up going with Martha Webb, who was the agent for Robin Doolittle, because she was just,
right,
she understood me and was very gentle and kind, and didn't see, my biggest fear was to like have someone come in that wanted to sensationalize the whole thing. And she wasn't like that at all. She wanted to hear like my future plans and like talk about me as a client, not just limited to this one book. And then she kind of pitched it to her, you know, contacts in the book publishing industry. And there were a bunch of publishers that just want to set up meetings with us. The first one, Penguin Random House, and the editors, David Ross, they insisted to be the first in the lineup of conversations, for a very strategic reason, which later became apparent, which is, you know, he wanted to like suss out the story. He wanted to suss me out and figure out that it was really what he wanted to do, and for me to feel comfortable with him and all of that. And then they had 24 hours later, we had like an offer, and it was, I talk about openly about it because I think like students should also know how much. And I got a $60,000 advance.
Which is totally normal, right? Everybody's getting those.
No, exactly. Exactly. Nothing about this is normal or average.
After one conversation.
Exactly. Like, and you know, I was being told like, oh, you know, by like people in the industry, like you get like $2,000 or something like that or whatever, you know what I mean? So I have no expectations. And so they gave it, he's like, you know, we have 24 hours to accept this offer and cancel all the other meetings, essentially.
That's a preempt. They were preempting. It's a total preempt.
Exactly. That's what it was.
Well, I mean, you did say you lived a privileged life. You're doing just fine.
Exactly.
After this conversation, I'll hit you up to sponsor the podcast, maybe.
Right.
Spread that wealth around. You connected with Martha because she was talking to you on a very human, non-sensational level. But you could see this going the other way with someone being like, yeah, Muslims are hot and sex is, I love this, like the secret shame of Muslim sex or something. Were you worried that that's what you might have encountered once you started bringing this story out to editors and agents?
Yes, absolutely. That was my number two fear. I was going to call it my number one fear, but then I remembered a bigger one. My number two fear was this.
Number one is the virginity thing, the loss.
That my ex would read the book. No. No. The first one was that I would somehow not conceal the identity of the participants well enough who chose to be anonymous, and that they would somehow be found out and have some, you know, something terrible or violent or whatever happened to them. That was my number one fear. There's only one out of six who's using her real name.
Oh, okay. And which one was that?
Iman.
Oh, I was going to try to trick you.
I mean, I've actually done like, I was on CBC with her. So she's, it's great that at least one of them is capable of, or wanted to, not capable. So yeah, then the second fear was for all of this to be sensationalized. And it never was with the people that I worked with. Even like when it came to the book cover.
It wasn't like someone hiding their face or, you know.
Down and had a conversation like, is there anything you'd like to see on the cover? I was like, no, but I have a list of things I'd like to not see.
Okay, we need the list. What's a short list? What couldn't have been on the cover?
Well, I don't think anybody's going to do this, but I was terrified. So it was very, you know, exaggerated. I was like, I don't want any camels. I don't want any palm trees. I don't want anybody veiled. There's like one veiled woman in there. I don't want any, you know, like Middle Eastern lanterns. I don't want any, or like, you know, dunes in the back or whatever.
See, my damaged imagination went to like, oh, like I could see someone proposing like sexy burka.
Well, you know what? People have made that joke before. I was like, nothing like, you know, disrespectful like that too, because it's not about that. The designer, who I should mention her name because she does a lot of good work. Her name is Jennifer Griffiths. She came up with the concept of the fig cut in half. And it was, I loved it because it's the Middle Eastern vagina, essentially. I mean, if you want to do that kind of like representation of the vulva and all of that in the West, it's always like either an apple or, you know, some sort of, you know, fruit like that. That's very common here. So, you know, the version of that in the Middle East or the Mediterranean region and all that would be the fig, because we eat figs all the time.
So if you were in Morocco and you were texting for a hookup, you would be sending What a fig and I don't know what
fig emoji.
You did mention that everybody you worked with on the book, no one, everyone sort of respected it, and everyone was human and not trying to make it weird and exploitative. Did you encounter that once you started going out and doing media, or just encountering people who were just not quite on the same level of respect or integrity? Or did everyone kind of treat it respectfully?
I think everyone treated it with respect. I was prepared to react, you know, in a way, or like had like these things I wanted to say if I came across like someone, you know, insulting or whatever. But that never really came up. Like there was maybe one or two instances. One was a journalist who asked me a question, but as soon as I said no, she kind of like moved on, so that was fine. Her question was like, are you a practicing Muslim or something like that? And I was like, that has nothing to do, you know, like if you've read the book, that's the whole point,
right?
Is that there is no such thing as like, that doesn't matter. You know what I mean? I am a Muslim. I identify as a Muslim. That's all you need to know. Whether I
right,
pray
right.
fast or whatever, or eat pork and drink wine, that's my problem.
It's not like
Yeah.
A sign. It's not like a sign you put up, or a switch you flick, and it's either on or off.
Exactly, and that also that concept exists in the Muslim community big time as well, which is why it like triggers me so much. You know, this thing of like, oh, well, you're not Muslim enough, so like, why should we even listen to you? You know, or like, you're living with a man who is not Muslim or Arab, and you're not married, so you're going to hell. And anyway, so what, like, what do you know?
Well, I'm just going to skip over my next question, which was, are you a practicing Muslim? Okay, we'll just move on for that. Scratch that.
We should have had this like conversation in a bar. I was prepared less for people outside of the community than people for inside, you know, people inside the community. They're like conservative and stuff like that.
Right.
I was prepared to talk about like the fact that I am not a virgin. I am not married. I live with a man, as I said, who is non, is not within the community and all of that. And I was excited to actually have someone bring that up, but it never came up. Nobody ever judged me.
That's interesting, because a lot of people who have written similar books, not in terms of subject, but in relation to a particular community, there is often that blowback from within the community of like, it's not even so much what you're saying as the fact that you're saying it outside. You're airing dirty laundry. You are revealing secrets that the outside people shouldn't be knowing about. So you never got even that of like, why are you telling all these white people about how we raise our kids?
When I was doing the reporting and kind of looking for subjects and things like that, that kind of came up, because I was looking for people. I was putting out calls in, like, you know, Facebook groups with, you know, Muslim women, or, you know, very niche like spaces like that. And I did get some, you know, women that were like, can you just like drop it? Like, what? Why do they? Why do you need to talk about this so much? Why is this always a conversation? Why is this, you know, like, why does the world need to know about this stuff? And my answer at that time was, it's not for the white people. It's not for, you know, I'm doing this for us. It's not for them. It's not for the white gaze or the male gaze or any, you know, other perspective that isn't ours. It's actually for the women and non-binary people and trans people in our community who are quietly suffering in their homes about this topic, because nobody's talking to them about it. So there was that, but there was also some people think that I don't have enough Islamic theological background to be able to talk on these topics. You know, like, I'm not an imam, so what do I know? Someone also on Instagram called me a pig, which I was like, that's your best shot. Pork is tasty.
Yeah. That's pretty standard on social media, though. That's just table stakes. That's
Exactly. The people that I care about are the hundreds and hundreds of people who sent me like random messages to say, thank God I came across this book. I've been, battling with these issues for all my life. My parents aren't talking to me, or whatever it is. I don't think my parents can accept, or my family can accept that I'm gay, or whatever it is. Feeling, having, reading this book and reading that these people have gone through the same thing as me makes me feel less alone and gives me the strength to live my life authentically. And that means everything. Those kind of conversations, those messages erase all the, oh, you don't know what you're talking about, or oh, you're, going to hell for this, or any of that stuff.
And now I have to ask the difficult question, in that the book came out a year ago, almost exactly a year ago. Are you working on a new book? Are you deep into something, or have you been able to kind of move on from it? Or are you still kind of looking for the next subject?
I am working on a second book, and it is kind of riding off of the momentum of the first one. And I had to like really sit with myself and think about whether this is what I wanted to do, because you know how like all writers are like worried about being pigeonholed into like one topic or whatever.
Of course. Yeah.
So will I be known as the Muslim writer? I don't know, but I sat down with it and I don't think I care. One of the criticisms of Halal Sex, and I don't take it personally, is that it didn't talk about any actual dogma, any like verses. It just talked about their lives. It didn't say whether this is actually halal or haram, or what does the Quran say, or what do scholars say. I didn't give any of that. And some people pointed that out and they're like, oh, I wish there was more of that, or we could have, heard about that side, etc. I don't take it personally, because that wasn't the point of Halal Sex.
Right. It was much more cultural and social and less about the actual theological underpinning.
Exactly. It was, they're like short stories that were lived. And I tried to kind of stay outside of the stories while I told them without my judgment. But sometimes it kind of, I didn't succeed in that, in the sense that I was like, oh, like, I think you can tell like when I have like a soft spot for one of, the sources or whatever. So I started thinking about that, and I came across a lot of feminist Muslim interpretations of the Quran that blew my mind. And I can tell you when I brought this up, and when I actually read about it, I was like, wait a minute. this is not okay that we don't all know about this. Yeah, one of the things that you can't do in Islam that is haram is sex outside of marriage. And that kind of is a big deal in halal sex, right? In the book. That's kind of like the whole point of the conversation. But when I was doing research to understand where this, law came from, et cetera, and all of this stuff, I found certain interpretations that actually said, this law is not about private sexual intercourse. It's more about public indecency. And how so? Is because the only way to confirm the act and to actually have it, judged by whoever, is you have to have, I think, about like two witnesses or something. If you're having sex and there's two people sitting there with you, why is this party? It doesn't make any sense anymore if you actually think about it. If we have witnesses to the act, what are these people doing in your house?
Right? And also, aren't they doing something immoral by sitting there watching, going, yes. No, this is not right. Exactly. What you two are doing right now.
Exactly. Nope. It just doesn't make any sense. Like, when are you, when is it that there are multiple people in the space? It's either public indecency, when you're outside having sex on a bench in a park and people pass by and see you, or it's, a group activity in the privacy of your home.
I like that there's more than one witness, that it's not even just someone peeping. It's a group. So they need to confirm.
Yeah.
They have.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Which is in a sense, it's a positive, like kind of preventative situation, in the sense that people can't just bring up rumors about you and you'll go to jail for it or whatever. People have to witness what's happening.
Right.
Whether it's this act or, you know, theft or whatever it is that they're, you know, conducting.
This is a court transcript I want to read now. I want to see if anybody
Right. And then so when I read this, when I read about this interpretation, I was like, how wild is it that every law in Sharia in every Muslim country is based on this law when it actually could be completely misinterpreted? Right?
Yeah.
Mind blown. So that's one of those topics. There's obviously like the veil, there's a bunch of other things, inheritance, adoption, all of this stuff that I've come across, that there are multiple different feminist interpretations of it with a growing wave of Muslim female scholars and theologians. And most importantly, imams. There are women imams. It's something that kind of isn't usually allowed in Islam or like really encouraged, and oftentimes actually they forbid it. But there's about six around the world, one in France, California, Denmark, UK. And so the book I'm working on now is tentatively called Lady Imam, and it's essentially profiling these women across the world who are really doing dangerous work to promote women and Muslim women and a feminist viewing and egalitarian understanding of the faith. And with each profile, I'm going to discuss and analyze controversial, misunderstood topics like premarital sex and what the law could potentially be talking about, other than what mainstream Islam has led us to think.
Are you feeling a bit of a time pinch in the sense of, you know, the cliche of like every band has 20 years to write their first album and then they got to write their second one in like a year? You had years to build Halal Sex. You had all these years of interviews, and it was kind of until it was a project, it was you had all the time in the world. Now you have to write this thing very quickly. Is that a positive in the sense of it's pushing you to do it, or do you feel like you wish you had that same stretch of time?
Well, I think the conversation we're having today finds me at a different place than, let's say, if you'd spoken to me like a couple of months ago. I felt this sense of urgency that is self-imposed, and that really, like, a lot of pressure I'd put on myself, and I need to get this out, and I need to like write it up, and I need to, but I started. I was recently diagnosed with this thing called cervical spondylosis, which is essentially the discs in my neck are pinching the nerves, which is a degenerative disease and sends like, you know, pain and numbness throughout from my neck to my arm and all this stuff, which comes from sitting at a desk too long, sitting in front of a computer too long, and all of that stuff. So it is work. Kind of like it's a byproduct of like the kind of work that I've been doing and not taking any breaks and having a full-time job, but also working on a book and freelance articles and all of this stuff just to make it in this industry. And I've realized that for me to actually do good work in the future and going forward, I have to be a human being also. Which sounds crazy when you say it like this, but I think most writers and editors and all this stuff and book writers don't, we don't think about ourselves as like human beings as opposed to like a tool
Right.
to get certain information out.
Or also like I'll be a human being when I turn 50. Like
Yeah.
until then, I am a conduit for content and words and stories.
Exactly. And it's not fair in the sense that like you end up with, you know, issues, physical issues, emotional issues, you know, and then there's also, like the fact, the mental health. Like when I was writing Halal Sex, I was seeing my therapist like once a week for a while because it was just like really, it was a lot to carry and not be able to like have someone else to talk to about it, especially since it was all like, you know, pseudonym sources that I couldn't really share much information about. And then it's like the people who need this most, the benefits most, you know, like health benefits and all of this stuff, like mental health benefits, we don't have them.
You have to get a job at a college to get those.
Exactly. Yeah. Either that or you gotta, you know, go do comms at like a bank or something.
What Happened Next is produced and edited by me. The music playing under my voice is by the great Alex Lukashevsky, who is letting me use it for free. You can find more of Alex's music at alukashevsky.bandcamp.com. Thank you for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. There will be a new episode every Monday. Please buy more books, and not just new ones.